Roberts.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, August the 13th. Ooh, August the 13th. Friday the 13th.
Ooh, scary.
2010. I am your co-host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Joanne Chang.
Hello.
And our technician, John Pranger, who is running the controls. On today's show, we have two interviews for you. First up, we'll have local animal activist, Ray Vasudevan, of the Vancouver anti-fur group called Skinned, on the show to speak about her ongoing campaign against Guest Life Vancouver magazine, which regularly runs fur ads in its publication. She'll also be talking about her upcoming fundraiser next weekend to raise money for the campaign. And for our feature interview today, I am thrilled to have on the show a well-known hero in the animal rights movement who has been an activist for dolphins now for nearly 40 years. He was instrumental in making and starring in this year's Oscar-winning documentary film, The Cove, as well serves as the campaign director of the coalition Save Japan Dolphins and as the marine mammal specialist for Earth Island Institute. We have Rick O'Berry on the show today to talk about his ongoing work to save the dolphins and his upcoming trip to Taiji, Japan on September the 1st, which served as the central location for the film The Cove.
I'm so excited about that.
So I just also want to mention that The Cove will be making its U.S. television debut in a few weeks on August the 29th at 9 o'clock p.m. on the Animal Planet Network. I don't believe we get Animal Planet here in Canada, certainly not on just the regular cable, unfortunately. However, for us Canadians, you can watch your local CBC listings, as I believe they will be showing it at some point in the future as part of their ongoing documentary screenings. Also, Rick O'Berry will be starring in a new television miniseries starting on August the 27th on the Animal Planet Network called Blood Dolphins. This series is directed by his son, Lincoln O'Berry, and will chronicle the efforts of Earth Island Institute and Rick around the world to protect dolphins. Rick and his Save Japan Dolphins crew go back to Taiji for the first time since the release of the Cove movie to find out what is now happening there with the dolphin kill.
Well, I wonder, you know, it would be great if they would show that in Vancouver, because you heard about the $25 million our government just gave to the Vancouver Aquarium.
Yes, I heard that from you, I think, actually.
I mean, that's just awful. And with all this attention around this issue, it's just so sad we're so far behind.
Yeah, I think definitely CBC will be showing it soon. I actually phoned them this morning and they didn't have any information. They said check back in September, but it's possible they might even be showing it this fall, and I know I actually suggested it to them earlier year, so
they
already played one documentary this year that I suggested.
Awesome.
That was Food Inc., so I'm like their advisor, right? So
maybe they have to clear it with the aquarium first. Can we show this movie?
Yeah, I don't know. Although CBC is Canada-wide, so hopefully they will go ahead and do it. And being an Academy Award winner, I'm sure that it shouldn't be too hard to get that on the air. Joanne, you would like to discuss with us today the social issues of veganism.
Yeah, so, you know, nowadays with Daya cheese, Silk soy creamer, and Gardein protein, plant-based products are doing a bang-up job mimicking the taste and texture of animal products. So why is it that people are having such a hard time going and staying vegan? The answer, I think, has nothing to do with food, really. Lots of people are resisting going vegan or staying vegan because it is socially awkward. And I don't blame them. Humans are social creatures, and in many social situations, if you don't do exactly as everyone else, you feel awkward, and everyone else feels awkward. And unfortunately, a lot of our socialization happens around food and drinks. So in a way, you know, being vegan is a lot like being a recovering alcoholic, but maybe harder because our society values people who are designated drivers, but no one really cares about vegans. So today I want to discuss some of the socially awkward situations that vegans find ourselves in and the way we deal with it. And sometimes even,
that could be a whole show. You've got 4 minutes.
I got 4 minutes. Well, I'm just gonna share something that I've had to deal with in the past, because I work in an office, so that means, you know, birthday cakes come maybe once a month or so, and it actually is worse for me because at my job we have cookie day every Friday. This is why I don't work Fridays anymore.
What's cookie day about?
Oh, it's the company provides money for you to buy, like, sweets, and everybody gathers around. And
of course
and
they would buy you
food.
Vegan cookies.
No, they wouldn't. No. So, you know, it used to make me really uncomfortable to just stand around while everybody ate the cake. And, you know, not only that, it makes other people around me feel uncomfortable. And they're always trying to offer the cake to me. And I would have to say, no, I don't eat that. And it just happens so often that I've considered being non-vegan at work just to fit in. I've actually really, really considered this because it just feels so awkward and happens every friggin' week.
Hearing you say that is a huge thing because you're one of the strongest vegans I know, Joanne.
Really?
Totally. Yeah.
So it's really hard for people, I think, in a situation like that where there's no support. But, you know, for me, the thought of eating a creamy, dairy-frosted cake makes me want to vomit. So.
Well, those cakes are they like from the store? Because those store-bought cakes usually look pretty gross. Anyways, like those sheet cakes from Safeway, that doesn't even tempt me, to be honest.
No, I mean, the food doesn't
even taste that good.
I would have to, if I had gone that way, I would have to, like, swallow it, like, you know, holding my nose and gulp down water. But it's the social situation, again. It has nothing to do with the taste of the food. But then I came to realize that the only thing I'm really worried about is the fact that I'm not doing exactly what everyone else is doing at the exact same time. So when you break it down, it doesn't really make any sense. And, you know, it seems kind of silly, really, because I don't wear the exact same outfits as my coworkers, and I don't go to lunch at the exact same time. So why is this cake eating ritual so sacred that we must do it all at the same time? And as soon as I realized that, things started to get a little bit easier. And I think when I stopped feeling awkward, people around me also stopped feeling awkward. So, you know, like whenever we have these cake celebrations, I would bring a cup of tea or granola bar so I have something to eat and do with my hands. And honestly, no one even notices or asks me anymore why I'm not eating the cake. And I just became like everyone else, and I don't even have to eat the cake.
I have a suggestion for you. You should do what Krista Truman does for her kids.
Yeah.
She used to be on her show. She keeps stores frozen vegan cupcakes in her in the freezer at her kids' school. So you could do that at work maybe.
And no, or I'm just going to cook. Sorry.
Or just, I don't know, just buy them from Whole Foods or something or from Krista.
Right.
And just keep them there. And every time it's birthday cake time, just bring out a cupcake and have your own delicious little cupcakes that you're eating.
Just for me.
Yeah, it's just my cupcake, and then you won't feel as socially awkward except for the fact that you have your own very own special cupcake. You'll just be special.
I think I've gotten over it. It's more like a crutch, so I just have my cup of tea now, and that feels just fine.
I'd love to talk about this more in the future. It's a fun topic.
Yeah,
living among meat eaters. There's
meat
a whole
eaters.
Book about that.
That's right.
Here are our upcoming events. Sunday, August the 15th, that's this weekend, from 1 o'clock p.m. until dusk, is the annual Chariot Festival of India, which happens at Second Beach in Stanley Park, Vancouver. This festival features lots of Indian cultural activities such as music, dance, live theater, and yoga and meditation, but most of all features vegetarian cooking demos and free veggie food. There will also be a parade starting at Beach Avenue at House Street at 11:30 a.m. going along Beach Avenue and finishing at the festival site at Second Beach at 1 p.m. at the start of the festivities. It sounds like a lot of fun. I haven't been before. I've always wanted to go. Have you ever checked out?
No, never.
Should go. this Sunday. For more information, visit chariotfestivalofindia.com. Lots of free veggie food.
Is this the first time they've done this? I've never heard of this before.
They've done it several times. If I'm not mistaken, I think I read it might be the fifth annual one.
Wow.
I know they've done it last couple of years. I've known of it. On Tuesday, August the 17th at 11:45 a.m., there will be a PETA demonstration called All Animals Have the Same Parts. This happens at the intersection of Georgia and Granville Streets in Vancouver. And if you're going, you can meet in front of London Drugs. Following the enormous success of Pamela Anderson's latest vegetarian ad, I don't know if you've seen that. She's painted with like a butcher's diagram. PETA will be in town with a demonstration that features a naked activist covered in body paint markings to mimic...
Is it Pam? Probably not.
I doubt it. Oh, can you imagine?
Yeah.
To mimic a butcher's diagram as well as a banner reading, All Animals Have the Same Parts, Go Vegan. Yeah. It'll still be a very big crowd draw, I think, right there in the heart of downtown Vancouver. So they need help to hold signs and pass out leaflets with information about factory farming and slaughterhouses to the public. The goal is to demonstrate that all animals are made of flesh, blood, and bone, just like you, me, and the animal companions with whom we share our homes. All materials will be provided. Just bring yourself, your family, and your friends. Please contact Virginia Ford at virginiaf@peta.org or at the phone number 757-213-8703 with any questions or to RSVP, and please mention the city in the demonstration in the subject line. You can also RSVP on Facebook by searching for Vancouver All Animals Have the Same Parts on the events page there. On Friday, August the 20th at 7 o'clock to 10:30 p.m. John, do we have our next interview on the phone? Perfect. On Friday, August the 20th at 7 to 10:30 p.m., there will be a fundraiser for the nonprofit group Stop UBC Animal Research at the Edge Pub at 303 Columbia Street in Vancouver. You are cordially invited to Stop UBC Animal Research's first fundraiser. Come enjoy good music and fine food in a modern gastropub setting. The ticket price is $5, and they're available at the door. Musical acts, sit back and enjoy the musical stylings of Dee Trevelyan and Reed Jameson, and then dance into the night with resident DJ Avery, which is Anthem Party Rock. Food and drinks and door prizes are going to be there, $2.50 for pints and $8.50 for pitchers. A vegan menu available, including delicious pizza with diet cheese. Come and have a fabulous time and support a great cause. All cover and ticket sales will go directly to UBC's Stop UBC Animal Research in association with the Haven Fund. Stop UBC Animal Research is an animal rights campaign that employs peaceful, legal, and compassionate approaches to educate the public about the grim realities of research on animals at the University of British Columbia and to ultimately bring an end to research on animals at UBC. So that's it for events this week, and we do have our next interview on the line. Ray Vasudevan is the coordinator of Skinned, a local animal protection group that focuses on the protection of fur-bearing animals. Today she will be speaking with us on her ongoing current campaign against Guest Life Vancouver, which is a widely distributed printed hotel publication that regularly publishes advertisements for fur. Hi, Ray, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Hi, thank you.
So please tell us about your organization, Skinned, and what is its purpose?
Oh, Skinned is a grassroots anti-fur organization. We've been around since 2003, and we basically focus our attention on fur businesses and try and weaken them in as many ways as we can, often in a strategic way.
So please tell us about the Guest Life campaign. What is Guest Life Vancouver, and why have you chosen to target this publication for this campaign? What is your goal for this campaign?
Oh, okay. Well, Guest Life Vancouver is a high-end tourist publication that's in many of the 4 and 5 diamond hotels in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, it's in about almost 40 hotels. And it basically tells tourists where to eat and shop. And two of Vancouver's largest furriers advertise every year in it. And those furriers are Papa's Furs and Holt Renfrew Fur Salon. And the publication really increases their reach. Mm. The furriers make a lot of money by being in it because it costs a lot of money to be in it. And we want to see those ads gone.
Uh-huh. So what kinds of tactics have you used in the past in this campaign to get those fur ads gone?
Well, we've sort of used some of the usual tactics that most activists use, you know, demonstrations and, you know, petition signatures. And we also did a little bit of civil disobedience with this campaign as well. I put myself up for arrest at the Wedgwood Hotel mm-hmm. in 2008. And we just, you know, have to keep on going that way. And now what we're doing is, you know, we're just sort of increasing our pickets. We're doing multiple pickets on a weekly basis rather than just one. So we want to build up the campaign. We want to build up the momentum now because they'll be signing contracts pretty soon.
So, Ray, your targets are the hotels that carry the publication?
The hotels that carry the publication, yes, because they okay. create the market for this. All high-end furriers in Canada will make some effort to access the tourist market, especially the luxury tourist market, you know, people who have a lot of money, and all these four and five diamond hotels cater to that sector. So it's really important if you want to, I mean, you know, some of our targets are so big. Papa's Fur, for example, is so huge, you can't go at him straight mm-hmm. on. You have to come at him from the side. You have to try and find out how he markets himself and weaken him that way. So that's our approach.
I understand you have contacted all the hotels that subscribe to this publication and that there were actually one or two that decided to stop carrying it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Actually, we haven't contacted all of them yet, but the Hilton has been really sympathetic, the Hilton Metrotown. Mm-hmm. And they have, the GM there has been very clear that he doesn't want that publication in the rooms if they continue
nice.
Advertising for fur.
And what about the Hyatt and the Pan Pacific?
They went back on their word, and I'm still trying to figure out why. A lot of what happens in these corporations is a lot of decision-making is done, well, in some of them decision-making is done by a team, and others the GM has more of a ultimate say. And it just depends on, you know, how they are making decisions, and I just need to figure out what's going on there in terms of that.
So one could say that you've definitely learned a lot in the past years about how these big corporations work through your campaigning. What have you learned through this campaigning?
Well, you know, they're just sort of not this kind of, they appear to us like this big sort of monolith, but really they are, it really boils down to, you know, the relationships that sort of exist behind them. With who is making the decisions and, you know, who has the ultimate say. And you have to figure all that out. That's sort of the intriguing part of campaigning. It's just this sort of huge puzzle that you have to take apart, put together, and, you know, you have to be willing to sort of shift your tactics the more you find out, if need be.
So please tell us about your future plans for this campaign and the video unit that you are fundraising for.
Oh, yes. We want a Faunavision unit. I've wanted one for years.
And what's Faunavision for our listeners who don't know?
Oh, I'm sorry. The video unit that you mm-hmm. referred to.
Right.
It's actually sort of the most powerful tool in my mind that you can have.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to fundraise for it through a garage sale and through a raffle.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to, you know, we want to use it in front of the hotels who aren't cooperating and so on. And right now, you know, the video unit just does the work of 10, 15 people. I mean, seeing mm-hmm. these animals being killed in motion, nothing can sort of replace that. I know it sounds kind of horrific, but really, it is so powerful.
So when you're showing these types of videos, when you have been showing images to people on the streets and that, what has the feedback been generally that you've been getting from just passersby, just the public who maybe are going into these hotels?
Oh, well, the general public is very sympathetic. You know, I mean, the pictures mm-hmm. they're so graphic, they're so violent. And the clientele that goes to the Wedgwood, I believe they are anti-fur, but I, you know, I'm sort of there to kind of ruin their happy time, I guess, mm-hmm. when they're busy having their lunches and whatnot, because I actually show these images through the restaurant window that's there. And, you know, everyone needs to know, and there's just no excuse for this industry, so...
Do you think that if everyone really did know, because I do agree that probably people just don't know it, you know, how these animals are treated and how they're killed and that. Do you think that is really the key, is just raising awareness? If people knew, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't support it.
I think raising awareness is not enough. I think because some of that is based on voluntary compliance. It's just not enough to give people information. I think... you know, you end up having to, especially with businesses, you end up sort of having to twist arms a bit.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's hard on one end if you're giving people that information, saying, you know, why fur is cruel and wrong.
Yes.
And then on the other end, these same people, the public, are seeing these fur ads in the magazines.
Yes.
It's like one cancels out the other, or maybe one's stronger than the other, you know?
Right.
Can you please tell us about some of the realities of fur and how the fur from animals such as minks, rabbits, and dogs come from being on the animals to being made clothing out of?
Oh, okay. Well, actually, the fur industry is becoming more violent and more deceptive. The whole thing has shifted to China, mm-hmm. in large part. Scandinavia is... There's a huge sort of movement in Scandinavia against the fur industry, and that's happened quite recently. China is basically keeping the industry buoyant, from what I can see. And animals are being skinned alive there quite routinely, you know, mainly mink and fox. Those are sort of the backbone of the fur industry. Dog and cat fur, I mean, that's sort of, you know, that's happening in large part in China as well, and that's done quite surreptitiously from what I understand. But our targets are basically luxury and furriers. They don't deal in dog and cat fur. They don't deal in rabbit fur. It's all, you know, lynx and mink and fox and just high-end furs.
And if I can jump in there, Ray,
yeah.
Papa's Furs actually advertise and say, oh, you know, we proudly carry Canadian fur. Is it any better if the fur is produced in Canada?
No, not at all. He carries a lot of wild-caught fur as well, you know, things like lynx and whatnot. It's just as, you know, the industry here is just as depraved as anywhere else, you know. We might not be skinning animals alive as routinely as they are in China, but it's still a brutal industry wherever it roots itself.
So who is buying this fur?
Oh, well, for our targets, you know, for example, with Papa's Furs, his market is the custom market. He custom designs coats for people.
Okay.
So he sells a lot of full length fur garments and stuff like that. That the local Vancouverite population is not his target, except for, you know, there's a population in Richmond that he sort of caters to. But for as far as as far as downtown Vancouver goes and whatnot, his market there is definitely the tourist market. He's also one of the last manufacturing furriers in North America. So he also, I'm sure he's doing a lot of exporting as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the average Vancouverite is not his client.
So please tell us about the fundraising event that you'll be having on August the 21st and 22nd to raise funds to buy and build this video unit.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just basically a garage sale. And it's going to take place here in my carport between 10 in the morning and 6 p.m. in the evening. We also have some really neat furniture to sell as well, really nice, like a really nice hallway table, dinner table, really nice chair. And we're still accepting donations if people are interested. And I can come pick those up or they can drop them off here.
Okay, and should they just give you a phone call or an email?
Yeah, that would be very helpful. I'll leave you my number here. It's 604-325-5092. And my email address is sayno2fur 2001 at yahoo.ca.
That's perfect. And if the people want to go to the garage sale to support the sale and support your fundraising, where can they find your garage sale at?
Oh, okay. My address here is 8249 Shaughnessy Street, and that's one block east of 67th and Oak in Vancouver.
Oh, perfect. So that's next weekend. I can't remember if you mentioned the times. 10 to 6, did you say?
Yeah, 10 to 6, both days.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ray, for coming on the show to speak to us about fur and your campaign to help the fur-bearing animals keep their fur on them. For more information on the fur industry, you can check out furisdead.com. Thanks a lot, Ray.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Coming up next is our news, and I only have one news item, and it's a huge news item. An article appeared yesterday in the front page of the Vancouver Sun entitled UBC Fears Animal Activists Campaign. And the article says animal rights activists have started a campaign to raise awareness about the grim realities of University of British Columbia animal research, which they say have been hidden from the public for years, even though the work is funded by taxpayers. The campaign is worrying UBC officials, one of whom said he is afraid it could lead to violence because there are nuts out there. That's the actual quote.
I thought that was really generalizing the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. It is. He's just trying to avoid the subject because people just want to find out what they're doing, right?
Well, if that's the angle that he's coming from, you know, pick something else. Because, right. And then the actual group is quoted as saying, no, this is a peaceful campaign. Don't worry about that. And then he says, no, I'm sure that they're going to be peaceful, but it's other people who might come out now and other crazy people who might lash out at us because of this.
Yeah. And they're actually, you know, all they're doing is asking questions. Like, what are you doing to all the 100,000 animals in your labs?
They won't release that information under the Freedom of Information Act, right?
And so if anybody who's going to ask questions is going to be accused of being violent, I don't think anybody's going to listen to UBC much longer if they keep going down this road. So few local residents are aware that UBC has such an extensive research program. Campaign organizer Brian Vincent told the Vancouver Sun, unfortunately, UBC has been less than forthcoming about its research activities. The public has a right to know that their tax dollars are paying for highly invasive research on animals, including experiments on cats. The group has been refused, as Allison said, information about animal research through the Freedom of Information requests. So as a result of this article, CKNW had a half-hour program dedicated to the issue of animal research. And
half hour? When was that? I missed it.
It was yesterday from 4:30 to 5. Mm. And representing Stop UBC Animal Research is none other than our own John Pranger. But he is busy on the phone right now, so he can't talk to us about what he said. But he did an amazing job.
Why don't you tell us, Joanne? Since I missed it.
Well, John said some really interesting things about, you know, I think it would be much better if he told it to us. Well, we'll let him have an opportunity probably later on. But besides John, CKNW interviewed Dr. John Pippin of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Pippin made some really important points. He said that, yes, we have made some medical progress because of animal research. He doesn't deny that. But he equates these medical advances from animal research to throwing darts with a blindfold on. So it is inevitable that you will hit the dartboard once in a while, but you're just gambling with probability. And Dr. Pippin made a very important point when the host asked him, do you propose we do these experiments on humans instead? The doctor responded, you know, we already do. And this is something that not everybody knows about. Because the doctor says the data from animal research is so unreliable that the USDA requires that before any drugs can be released to the public, they have to go through human trial. And some of these drugs that have been deemed safe on animals, even with massive amounts given to them, have nearly killed humans in human trial period. So, you know, it's just the whole thing doesn't make any sense when, you know, animal researchers always hang on to this idea that, you know, we are saving lives and, you know, who cares if we have to kill some monkeys? We're making real scientific progress. But as we know, if these animal research are working, how come, you know, we're doing all these, you know, breast cancer research, prostate cancer research, AIDS research, and I know personally a lot of people who have been involved in fundraising, and just think of the billions of dollars that have been raised just to cure a few diseases. How come we haven't found any cure so far? So, you know, it's kind of, you know, doesn't make any sense to me, and I think the public needs to start being aware of it, and hopefully something will come of this campaign.
Thank you so much, Joanne. You are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Our feature interview today is with Rick O'Berry, the former dolphin trainer turned marine mammal activist who was first recognized in the 1960s for capturing and training the dolphins that were used in the well-known TV series Flipper. Soon after Kathy, one of the Flipper dolphins, died in his arms after committing suicide, he made a radical transition from training dolphins in captivity to assertively combating the captivity industry. Rick was featured in the documentary The Cove, a film that uses covert techniques to expose the yearly dolphin drive hunting that goes on in Taiji, Japan. And this film went on to win the Academy Award earlier this year for Best Documentary Feature Film. Mr. O'Berry is the Marine Mammal Specialist for Earth Island Institute and Director of the Save Japan Dolphins Coalition. Hello, Rick, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I'm just a little bit out of breath here from calling you in
welcome,
the other room.
Rick. We're so excited to have you on.
We're very happy to have you here today on the Animal Voices radio show. Mm-hmm. You are the pioneer of the dolphin protection movement and have been working to free dolphins in captivity for nearly the last 40 years. You are also the person who was most solely responsible, some might say, for the success of the dolphin entertainment industry. Can you tell us how you got started working in the industry of capturing and exporting and then training dolphins?
Well, I went to work at the Miami Seaquarium. It opened in 1955, and, well, I should back up. The first time I went to the Seaquarium, I was on leave, 14-day leave from the Navy boot camp, and that was Christmas Day, 1955, opening day, and I was there, and I saw the diver underwater with a helmet on, walking around with a canvas suit, and I never saw a scene like that before, a huge 500-pound grouper and, you know, 100-year-old turtles, 300-pound turtles and sawfish and dolphins, and it was surreal. And I thought, God, when I get out of the Navy, I'm going to come back here and get that guy's job. And I did. 1960, I went there, went to work, and I didn't start diving in that tank, though, for about a year. My first day on the job was on the capture boat. We were capturing dolphins in Biscayne Bay here in Miami.
So what was it like working on the Flipper show and training the dolphins? Did you enjoy it?
I did. You know, I was as ignorant as I could be for as long as I could be, and it was the 60s. You know, 1960, we didn't have the information we have today. Today, we know that there's only three things killing dolphins: our fishing nets, our pollution, and our captivity. Captivity kills. But I didn't know that when I was 20 years old.
Well, and imagine, too, as you said, that information wasn't really out there. It was kind of the beginning of the industry, as far as I know. Was this the beginning of the era of keeping marine mammals in captivity?
The first dolphin park was in St. Augustine, Florida. It opened in 1938. Hmm. And then in California, Marineland in Palos Verdes opened up in, I think, 1950, and then Miami Seaquarium on Christmas Day, 1955. So, yeah, that was the third, the only, the third place in the world, and And we were capturing dolphins for the U.S. Navy. Well, it was the CIA in those days, and later taken over by the Navy, and we were capturing them for other places. So, yeah, I was part of the problem,
mm-hmm.
realizing, of course, that this was a problem.
And what were you and your colleagues learning about the dolphins at this time and about keeping dolphins in captivity? What were you learning about how being in captivity is like for dolphins?
Well, I wasn't learning anything. I wasn't trying to learn anything. I was just interested in making a lot of money and having fun, chasing girls. You know, this was 1960s, and it wasn't about education or research and all that stuff. The industry hides behind this education and research. We weren't doing that in 1960. It was all about casual amusement.
I'm wondering, why did the CIA want you to capture dolphins?
The CIA started the Navy Dolphin Program.
And
were very involved in it. It was later, this was at Point Magoo Naval Undersea Warfare School in Point Magoo, California.
So can you please tell us about Kathy and how she died by committing suicide? And why do you think she did it?
She looked me right in the eye, took a breath, and never took another breath. And your listeners have to understand, dolphins are not automatic air breathers like we are. Every breath is a conscious effort. So they can do that any time they want to. And I think that happens all the time. It's just not logged in as, suicide.
Right. And why would you... I understand Kathy was one of the main dolphins that played the flipper role out of, I think it was, 5 different dolphins.
She was actually a flipper for the TV show. She was the one who we used 99% of the time.
Wow.
So, she was very... I lived with them for more than 7 years.
Why do you think she chose not to take another breath?
Depression. Captive dolphin depression syndrome, I call it. And, again, I think it happens at strandings. It happens in Taiji. I witness it in Taiji every time I go there.
Oh, my goodness. Rick, what is so special about dolphins to you as someone who has lived and worked with them extensively?
Well, they are to the sea, but we are to the land. They're our equals. They are self-aware like we are. They're highly social. They are altruistic. And that's something that we attribute to humans alone, but actually dolphins have saved the lives of humans throughout history. We have good evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we never heard of another wild animal coming out of the jungle or a farm animal to save a human life.
No.
So, yeah, there is something special about them.
In all of your years of working with dolphins, what have you learned about their intelligence as we humans measure it?
The most important lesson I've learned is they don't belong in captivity. It's a failed experiment. It never worked. And I'm not sure of that word intelligence I've struggled with for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
They're not more intelligent than we are, and they're not less intelligent than we are. They're simply different. I've learned that. Mm-hmm. But intelligence is a human concept. We're not very intelligent at all from a butterfly's point of view. We can't do any of the things that they do. So it's a human concept, intelligence.
What about self-awareness? I understand that you used to show the flipper show to Kathy on your television, and she would know who was her and who were the other dolphins playing the same role.
Exactly, yeah. And I would show it, bring a television set down there with a long extension cord. And
in the 1960s. Oh.
So I knew then they were self-aware. That's when I knew they were not, they didn't belong in captivity, but I didn't do anything about it until she died.
Can you tell us how your activism work started to save the dolphins, which you just precluded to? I heard on another interview that you did where you said you'd rather be home watering plants. So why are you driven on your quest to save the dolphins?
I was doing that when you called. I was actually in the back. I am there right now in the back garden. I have 9. Well, now this guy just brought over the 10th. I have 10 different kinds of bamboo here. And, yeah, I would rather spend my time back here in the garden with the bamboo than in Taiji with fishermen who want to kill me.
Right.
Or in Solomon Islands or Guatemala, Nicaragua, Colombia, and where else. I've been all over the world on this long and strange trip, and it's always about conflict, and it's always about Well, that's what I mean. I would rather be at home with people who love me than be out there with people who want to kill me. I spend most of my time with people who want to kill me.
You've said that you feel responsible because it was the Flipper TV series that created this multi-billion-dollar industry. Do you think that's part of why you go out and do what you do for the Dolphins now?
Yes, it is what motivated me initially on Earth Day 1970 for many years afterwards, but not anymore. Now I do what I do automatically. It's like breathing. I really don't think about breathing, and I don't think about the work I'm doing. I just do it. What I have to do is laid out in front of me, and I just go and do it. I don't really think about it.
So you're talking about going to all these different countries. From what I understand, you're constantly getting phone calls from people all around the world who say you need to come here and save this dolphin. So you go there, and then what happens?
It's different in every place. For example, I was in Solomon Islands. I've been going there for many years. They've been killing dolphins in Fanalei.
It's pretty bad there.
Sorry?
It's pretty bad there from what I've seen.
Yeah, well, they've been doing this for 400 years, just like Taiji. They kill about 200 a year, just like Taiji. Very similar. Different boats. These are canoes. Very, very primitive people and very primitive boats. And we were there on April 8th when it stopped. It came down like the Berlin Wall, and we recorded it for Animal Planet, and that'll be seen on Animal Planet. The series starts on the 27th. Mm-hmm. It's called Blood Dolphins, as in blood diamonds, not as in the code, but it has to do with the dolphin, captive dolphin trade, which fuels what's going on in Taiji. So, yeah, I see success, you know, and that's what keeps me going now, not guilt, but more about the results.
I'd like to talk about the fantastic documentary film that you are the star of, The Cove, and how that came to be. I understand that the director of the film, Luis Sahayas, just approached you one day and asked if he could follow you around with a video camera to document your dolphin activism work, and then you invited him to go with you on your next trip to Taiji, Japan. How did that first meeting suddenly develop into The Cove film, which can be perhaps described as a Mission Impossible adventure that follows you and your team making the dangerous trip into Taiji to record undercover footage of the dolphin massacre in Taiji?
Well, that was a phone call. Most of what I did was a phone call. It used to be a phone call or a fax or emails. But I got a call from this guy saying, can I follow you around with my camera? I said, okay, but I'm leaving tomorrow for Taiji. And he said, I'll meet you there. And with that, I found out later, he went out and took a 3-day crash course on how to make a movie. He never made a movie before.
Wow, didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you see Sharkwater, by the way?
Yes, I have.
Well, I told that story to Rob, I forget his last name, the guy who produced and directed that in New York, that story of how Louis never made a movie. He said, hey, I got a better story than that. He said, when I went out to make Sharkwater, I was on the airport with my
Rick, we're losing your reception there. I'm not sure if you're in a cordless, but we can't really hear you right now.
Okay,
is that better? Yeah, I can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. So you said that you talked to the director from Sharkwater.
Yeah, and I told him that story about the fact that Louis never made a film before.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I have a better story. He said, I was on my way to make Sharkwater in the car with my girlfriend. She gave me a booklet, How to Make a Movie.
Wow.
So he never did it either. And here we have two great movies. So the reason I mention that is some of your listeners may be aspiring filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, and I want to encourage them to go out and do it. Even if you don't know how to do it, just show up and do it. And surround yourself with people who know more than you do, because that is the activism of the future.
Thank you for that.
And you might win an Oscar.
Yeah, side bonus. How difficult a feat was it to shoot the movie and to actually successfully execute this Mission Impossible of entering a town where you've been threatened with death if they ever see your face there, and then illegally breaking into the cove to capture this video footage that you knew would make a world of difference for the dolphins if it was released to the public? From what we see in the edited film, it looks like a terrifying endeavor, not to mention extremely ambitious, and has been described to be this on the same caliber as a military operation.
Well, yeah, I was in the military, and it was I was in an anti-submarine hunter-killer group for 5 years, hunter-destroyer, and it's very much like that. But the problem in Taiji, there's multiple detractors. You have the fishermen, you have the local police, you have the Shingu police, you have national police from Tokyo, you have the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia, and you have these right-wing militant groups all trying to stop you. Yeah. So it's much more complicated than a normal battlefield, and you have to... And I'm very, very surprised that somebody didn't get arrested or get hurt or get the film confiscated and shut down, because that was just a matter of luck. That wasn't, had nothing to do with talent.
That sounds even more scary now that I hear of all these different groups being involved. I just want to remind our listeners that this is the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver. Rick, can you tell us exactly what is happening in Taiji, Japan, every year from September to March? And how long has the dolphin massacre been going on for? What are the logistics involved in this massacre?
Boats, 13 boats, leave the harbor when the sun comes up. They go many miles offshore where they find migrating dolphins. They get their boat on the outside of them. They put a long pole in the water, a metal pole, and the boats are evenly spaced out. They beat the pole with hammers and create an underwater acoustical net, if you will, or an acoustical wall. And this, of course, frightens the dolphins, terrorizes them, and they are able to drive them into shore and into this killing cove. There they're met with dolphin trainers from various dolphin swim programs and dolphin therapy and dolphin circuses. And they take the best ones for themselves, and the rest are slaughtered.
How many dolphins are being killed in Taiji every year?
Well, in Taiji there's about 2,000 in Japan, there's about 20,000 each year.
Wow, so it's not
just other places this happens, but it's much more difficult to witness it because it takes place on the high seas and it involves held harpoons and bows and arrows.
How much money is involved? How much are the dolphins being sold for to these dolphinariums?
Well, there's I know that Ocean World Casino, you can Google that, in the Dominican Republic, paid $154,000 for each of the 12 dolphins they bought. I know that because I have the contract, and in fact, they were never imported into the Dominican Republic because we went there and met with the Minister for the Environment, and so they, and also two of the Taiji City Councilmen wrote to the minister and said, if the dolphins die, if they die in the DR, don't put them in the ground. They are toxic waste, and you have to treat because they're heavily contaminated with mercury, methyl mercury, and PCBs. So as a result, they were not allowed into the DR, and I'm now being sued and my employer, Earth Island Institute, for about $700 million.
Wow, that's way more than... I guess that would be what they are losing from not having... the dolphin.
No, they wouldn't ever make $700 million. It's just it's a form of harassment.
Right.
But it's just, so we don't have to pay the lawyers. We have pro bono lawyers, and so we're not spending our resources on this. And they know they can't win. It's been going on for 3 years, but their agenda is to inflict as much damage as possible. They know they can't win this lawsuit.
I'm curious, Rick. You said the Japanese Yakuza and the government and all the people are after you. Why? What's their interest in this?
Their interest is to keep doing what they're doing and take out anybody who gets in their way. We've had, you know, we have, when we go back this time, when I say we, I'm talking about, we have 80 countries now. We have 1.4 million signatures, people who are opposed to what's going on there. And so this is a big problem for them. This has given them international media, negative media.
So it's a matter of pride rather than money, or?
I think it's both. I think it's Both of those, sure.
So why do you think the Cove has been such a success with the public? Why has it made such an impact, in your opinion?
Well, it's a different kind of film. I've never seen a film like that. I'm not one of the filmmakers, so I can say that. They did a great job, and they've moved on to their next movie. But they've created an army, a legion of activists with the film. That's what's different about it. People see it, and they want to do something.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be four dolphins. It might be something about the oceans. It might be something about global warming. It might be about whatever. People become activists, and that's I think that will happen with Blood Dolphins, the new TV series my son Lincoln is producing and directing.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah, that's going to air the 27th, and I think that's going to create a legion of activists.
So you have said that it would be a nightmare for the Japanese government if we win the Academy Award for the film. Well, you won. So has it been a nightmare for them?
Yeah, it has. It's now very popular in Japan.
Great.
Really? I understand it's being shown in theaters across Japan now.
Yeah, and it's doing very, very well, and that makes them angrier, them being the fishermen and the Yakuza and the right-wing groups. But the young people in Japan want to see it because they don't really eat whale meat, dolphin meat. They're not part of this. And when you tell the young people that don't see this movie, first thing they're going to do is buy a ticket.
Yeah.
So it's backfired on. Yeah.
So it's getting out there. Do you feel confident that your activism will eventually shut the Cove down?
Yeah, I think so. It could happen this year.
Wow. That's amazing.
Excellent.
A Japanese fisherman once told you, if the world finds out what's going on here, we'll be shut down. So you think it's just a matter of time, and it might even happen this year. Is that your ultimate goal for the dolphins, is to end the industry?
Yeah. Yeah, to shut it down. And I think it's happening.
Can you please tell us about your trip to Japan in a few weeks on September the 1st and what you will be doing there this year?
I can't tell you that because your program will be listened to by the Japanese embassy, and then they telegraph that information.
Wow.
And that is true. I've done so many interviews in Europe. I did three of them today. And if I let people know what we're doing, the embassy's job is to keep their finger on the pulse of what's being said about Japan and so forth. So I can't really reveal my plans.
Well, I look forward to reading about it, perhaps in the media or wherever we can get that information in a couple of weeks. And I understand that, you have a death threat on you. Are you scared to go?
Again, what was that?
Well, they've told you that they'll kill you if they catch you. Are you scared to go to Taiji?
Yeah. I would much rather stay home and water the bamboo. But, hey, a man's got to do what a man's got to do.
What do you think of families bringing their children to dolphinariums and aquariums where they want to give their kids the experience of swimming with and interacting with dolphins, but yet if they do that, it's at the expense of the dolphins and their lives and freedom?
Well, it's a bad idea, and I think your audience already knows that. I'm sort of preaching to the converted here, Animal Rights Network.
Well, the Japanese are going to hear this program, remember?
Right?
The Japanese are going to hear this program, remember? So.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the theory is if we display dolphins, people will go see them. They'll be sensitized, they'll be educated, and then they'll protect them.
So I understand that you still swim with dolphins yourself, but in the wild. What is that like for you?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, but let me just back up to what I just said. The theory is if we have these display facilities and display dolphins, it's going to sensitize people, and then they're going to protect them. And it sounds logical, but you only have to look at Japan, which has 51 dolphinariums.
Mm. That's a lot for such a small country.
It's the size of California. It has 51 facilities, and they all say the same thing. If we display them, we're going to sensitize people, educate them, and then they'll protect them.
That's never happened, though.
When I show up in the Cove September 1st, I won't be able to find one of these people.
Mm-hmm.
51 dolphinariums translates into 100 million people who have been educated, sensitized, and now they're going to protect the dolphins. Well, when are they going to get started?
Well, the Canadian government just gave the Vancouver Aquarium $25 million to expand the aquarium so they can have more dolphins.
I know all about that. And I've been out there campaigning to stop that expansion.
That's
but No, it's not happening. I know about the $25 million, and it's not going to translate into conservation. That's the big lie that somehow this translates into conservation, and people will protect seals and sea lions and whales and beluga whales, and it's simply not true. There is no evidence to support that theory.
So what can individuals who are listening to this program today do to help save the dolphins? What advice or information or do you have for them?
Well, I ask people first, don't buy a ticket for a dolphin show, for the Vancouver Dolphin Show, anywhere, SeaWorld, if you're coming to Miami, the Miami Sea Aquarium, don't buy a ticket. That's where the power is with the consumer. That's one thing. There isn't a lot they can do about what happens in Japan, people in Canada, but they can go to our website and support what we're doing. They can take action there and sign up and become part of the 1.4 million people who are opposed to this. And that's SaveJapanDolphins.org. That's where they can do that.
Thank you so much for that. Rick O'Berry, you are a hero to the people and to the animals.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming on the Animal Voices radio show today to speak with us about your ongoing work to save the dolphins. To find out more and how you can help, please go to SaveJapanDolphins.org. Also, if you haven't seen the cove yet and you live in the United States, it will be shown for the first time on television in the U.S. on Animal Planet on August the 29th at 9 p.m. And remember, there's the mini-series program, Blood Dolphins, starting on August the 27th, also on Animal Planet. It's also out on DVD, so please go out and rent it or buy it and watch it at home. It's a film that you won't want to miss. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. We are a community-supported program, so at this time I would like to encourage listeners to sign up for a membership or make a donation to Co-op Radio. If you find value in our programming on animal rights, and such as the interview we just had with Rick O'Berry, please designate your contribution in support of Animal Voices radio show. To make a donation or sign up for membership, please go to www.coopradio.org or call 604-684-8495. Extension 230. You can listen to our program online anytime at www.animalvoices.org, or you can download our podcast through iTunes by subscribing to Animal Voices Vancouver for free. We love to hear from your stories about animals, your transition to a plant-based diet, or any related topics. Drop us a line anytime at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And coming up next week, we will be speaking with a local activist from the Stop UBC Animal Research Campaign. Our feature interview is with J.B. McCahey. He is from the Chimp Sanctuary Northwest in Washington. The sanctuary is home to seven beautiful chimpanzees rescued from biomedical research facilities. You have been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Thank you for joining us this week, and stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock.